Welcome to Amped Up, Utility Insights, Trends and Challenges. I'm your host, Melissa Parvis, CEO of Athena, a consultancy and workforce solutions provider operating in the power sector. In this podcast, we explore the changing landscape of US electric utilities with great minds and insightful conversations.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. Today, we'll be addressing how the decentralization of the power supply will likely play a big role in addressing the clean energy transition and grid modernization initiatives. In recent years, some utilities have come under scrutiny for their lack of speed to address this change. And during this episode, we want to explore the topic of decentralization and how it may be a significant opportunity for utilities to get ahead of the curve. Today, I want to welcome my guest today, John Farrell. John co-leads the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. The institution advocates for research and policy change to promote the widespread production of renewable energy. John, thank you very much for joining me today. Let's kick it off with if you could share a little bit more about your journey and how you became a proponent for policy change in the electric utility industry.
Yeah, well, I think there's sort of two threads here. One is just that the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, which has been around for 50 years, has had this in its blood since the beginning. One of the first reports that we published back in the mid-1970s was called The Dawning of Solar Cells, and is looking at the opportunity from the fact it was the first factory that was built to make solar cells that would be used outside of the space program. So we've been thinking about this technology for a long time. And in some of the early modeling that we did for the city of Washington, D.C., which is where we were founded, we looked at what might it mean for the city to be able to produce some of its electricity locally in terms of keeping more of those dollars in the local economy. So this idea of producing energy close to where we use it has just been in the blood of the Institute for a long time. And then when I started about 15 years ago, that was right at the beginning of when solar energy was becoming economical to use in many places, and the expansion, you know, in California, some of the early policies in the United States moving us to doing more solars. It's been really exciting to see that development over the past decade or two.
That's interesting. So this has just become more and more important for change over the course of the last 50 years or so. So you're in an exciting spot then.
Absolutely. And I just feel, I mean, super grateful, honestly, to be able to work with such an exciting technology. And it's such an exciting moment of change in the industry where we have these technological opportunities to do things in a very different way than we have before, and increasingly in a less expensive way than we have before.
Let's start with explaining the concept of decentralization and how this fits within the clean energy transition.
Yeah, I mean, the central idea here is just and is really in contrast to the way that we've produced electricity for over 100 years. In the early days, we actually had sort of neighborhood power plants. They might serve 400 light bulbs was the way that they thought about it at the time, because that was the primary use of electricity. And what was quickly evident from the generation of electricity is that the bigger the power plant, the more efficient it was, the lower the cost of that electricity. And so we kept increasing the size of power plants until they became, you know, several football fields worth of infrastructure, and they could power hundreds of thousands of homes with a single power plant. And what we found is that, about 50 years ago in the 1970s, we sort of hit the limits of the technology opportunity to continue the bigger is better game. And we found out, actually, maybe there are opportunities to look at how we start to decentralize energy production. And there were some initial federal legislation at the time that started us on that course. But what's really done it more than anything is the advent of solar technology, which obviously allows us to put electricity production wherever we want. You know, we can have rooftop panels on our own homes like I do. We can have it on business roofs. We can have it in farm fields, you know, that are maybe not good for prime agricultural production. We give the farmer another source of income. So the idea here is essentially we can put power production in many places that we couldn't do so before. And that by doing decentralization of our power production, we can actually make the grid more resilient. We can serve energy needs closer to where we use energy. We can avoid losses in the transmission of electricity. We also have opportunities to create economic development from energy production because we can disperse where we are doing that energy production over a much wider area than we did before.
Playing devil's advocate for a second, obviously there is a lot of limitations when it comes to renewable energy, solar and wind in particular. I understand that the storage of the energy is still a limiting factor. What are your thoughts on that? Are you a proponent for complete transition, or do you think there's some sort of middle ground area that's best?
I don't think we have the affordable technology in place to like wave a magic wand and say everything is from renewables today. If we did that, I think the job of our utility managers would be extraordinarily difficult. But what I take heart in is I've done a couple of interviews with the CEO of the Kauai Island Electric Cooperative. It serves, you know, a few hundred thousand customers on that island out in Hawaii. It's an island, which means it's not connected to any other grid. They can't look to backup for anybody else. They have to really meet their own needs. And they're about 70% renewable right now, mostly solar. They have battery storage. I think they have a little bit of hydro, potentially, maybe some biomass. They have no wind, though, wind energy, because there are like migratory bird species near the island that would be impacted if they built wind turbines. And the lesson from them is that they've been able to actually lower the costs of electricity production, transitioning from oil, which was their primary source, and to make their grid more reliable and cleaner all at the same time. And when I interviewed the CEO, one of the things he said was, you know, yes, every technology has a drawback, right? Like a gas plant can have a problem with the pipes freezing, as happened in Texas in 2021. A nuclear plant can have a forced outage. You always have to plan a grid system around the fact that nothing is available 100% of the time. And that the more predictable that outage is, the better you can be prepared for it. So I always laugh because, you know, some people are like, well, the sun doesn't shine at night. It's like, yes, but we know exactly when it won't shine, you know, and our weather forecasting is pretty good. So, and that's the part that really matters from the management side of things is, do we know when those outages will happen? Do we know when we will need to have backup power or have other alternatives? Are those things available? And that's where energy storage, like with batteries, is really exciting. You know, we've seen gigawatts being installed now in places like California. We have some other interesting ways about how with technology we can manage when people use energy, you know, like a smart thermostat that can automatically, you know, shut off your air conditioner if energy demand is really high. So we have more tools at our disposal to manage it. And I think that as we go forward over the next few years, we'll continue to see it be possible to get even more and more electricity from renewable sources than we've ever been able to do before, and that you'll have the tools to do so affordably and to make sure that our grid stays reliable and resilient.
One of the interesting things you and I spoke about offline was this juxtaposition that utilities are finding themselves in meeting their financial objectives and also balancing this propensity for increased community service and increased decentralized power supply. I wanted to go a little bit more into that. Maybe if we could lay that out and start a discussion about that and those challenges that utilities are facing.
Yeah. I mean, I think utilities are facing a unique confluence of challenges, right? You have pressures from climate change that make things like wildfires or floods or hurricanes more common. You have the challenges of growing energy demand from, you know, data centers and particularly driven by AI. You have the fact that we are really slow to build large-scale infrastructure. And the problem that we have right now often is that as utilities think about how they can meet rising energy demand, the timelines, especially for new transmission lines, can often be in the decades, not in the years. And so there is this need to figure out how can we meet demand cost-effectively? How can we do it in a timely manner? How can we do it in a way that doesn't contribute to the increasing threat of climate change? And also, how can we get paid for it? And one of the things that is unfortunate, I think, for, you know, most utility managers, especially if you're an investor-owned utility, is that the incentives, financial incentives, haven't really changed. Like they continue to push you in one particular direction, even as the technology and the threats and the opportunities are becoming very different, especially over the last couple of decades. And I think it's a challenge, honestly, for any utility manager, whether you're a not-for-profit or a for-profit, but I think particularly for the for-profit utilities, the financial incentives that drive them, I think, often are not in the same direction as the solutions that might be the most cost-effective for everybody, the lowest pollution, et cetera.
So as we see an increased demand in electrification, what are some of the key challenges you see in meeting this demand?
First and most challenging thing is to make sure that our demand forecasts are strong and accurate. One of the things that bothers me about the entire conversation about data centers is that we know for a fact that the biggest cost driver for a data center, the biggest expense it's going to have, is buying electricity. So there's a really strong incentive for data center operators to figure out how to be more efficient. And we know that the technology with computer chips continues to get better. I mean, I think about all the time, like the laptop that I'm on right now for this call uses something like a quarter of the energy, if not less, than the desktop computer I might have used 10 years ago. And I think about the same kinds of opportunities for improvement with data centers, which obviously is like the big conversation right now about growing energy demand. Now, that's not the only thing. We also have electric vehicles. We have people that will be installing heat pumps. You know, a lot of shift in our energy usage from other sources to electricity. So I think we do have to be planning with the assumption that our electricity demand is going to grow and that utilities have to be prepared to deal with that. But I think that getting that forecast right is really challenging. And I think, it comes back to that idea of the financial incentives, right? If you know that your business model encourages you to build things to meet demand, it's hard not to have sort of like motivated reasoning, as in, oh, I want that demand forecast to be true because it will allow me to do things that I think would be really good for our shareholders. Getting those demand forecasts right is a really crucial piece of this. I think the second thing to think about with the demand growth and how we deal with it is, what are the ways that we can do so that are the most efficient? For example, if we know people are going to be using a lot more electricity in their homes, well, gosh, it would be pretty awesome if people also installed solar panels and met some of that electricity demand locally before having to call out to other parts of the distribution system or even up to the transmission system to bring that power in over longer distances. One of the things that we know that's true from electric grid operations is that the more that you can manage the needs of the grid locally, the better. I mean, just here's a great example of that. On a distribution line that goes out like through a neighborhood, through a city, when it leaves a substation, the utility usually dials up the voltage a little bit past 120 volts because they know that the voltage will drop as it goes out over the line. So that last customer is at a lower voltage than the first customer on that distribution line. But these days with things like solar panels, we actually have the ability to add power and add voltage along the course of that line. So we can actually have like the quality of the electricity we deliver can actually be better because we can place the production of it closer to where we use energy. So we have these really interesting opportunities to meet demand in ways that I think can actually improve the quality of the grid, the reliability of the grid. It's a huge challenge for utilities in this time of like trying to forecast that demand accurately, build those resources, make sure they have reserve margins, make sure they're able to handle those periods when severe weather or other unexpected events cause outages at power plants. I don't envy their job, honestly. And I'm really grateful for the folks who were there, have been experts in doing this and keeping the system as reliable as it is.
So in what ways do you think utilities could best pivot to facilitate these changing demands, these changing requirements that we're seeing with technology changes?
I mean, I think it's really about looking for where is there a confluence of business opportunity and the need. So, you know, one of the things that I remember from a former executive at Xcel Energy said, they serve Minnesota and a few other states across the country, was he had this phrase, steel for fuel. And the idea was that the utility recognized we can still make money doing renewable energy, just like we could make money building gas plants or nuclear plants. But the idea is that we're investing in the hardware upfront and that we earn that return on that hardware investment. And so I think utilities need to look for, again, what are those intersectional business opportunities? We saw an interesting proposal here in Minnesota from Xcel Energy to recently make investments on the distribution system, essentially doing solar and energy storage, thinking of places like warehouses that typically don't have solar panels on them right now, in part because the way our policies are designed don't encourage warehouse owners to do that. For example, you don't have a lot of on-site electric demand, and so there's no advantage to covering the roof of a warehouse with solar panels. And this is a place where there's an interesting opportunity to create a market, one that the utility could serve and one that third parties could serve. But I think that's an interesting place for utilities to look is, okay, if it takes a really long time to build a transmission line to bring online, you know, large projects for solar and wind power, where can we invest today that we can deploy quickly? And one of the things that was so interesting about Xcel Energy's proposal for this particular project was the language that they used saying, we recognize that this decentralized energy, the sort of like modular, you know, local energy can deploy really quickly. So when we're thinking about this intense pressure that we have up for demand growth, you know, should it pan out as we expect, this is a really big opportunity for utilities to have something that's nimble. So you don't maybe have to plan as far in advance for this demand growth because you can actually deploy energy production more quickly and in a more modular fashion. And there's an opportunity to grow a market that hasn't been there before to find places to insert this energy production. My organization's perspective, we're excited about that idea too, because of course you have the economic development opportunities that come with putting solar in many places in our built environment, in our cities, in our communities, where it will just go on top of existing infrastructure, but it will create jobs in order to install those panels, to do the wiring, to do the battery storage, and give the utility, hopefully, as well, more flexibility to help the grid in other situations by having that power more locally, and especially when it's paired with battery storage to provide backup for the local grid and a lot of other services. So I really think, you know, this is an opportunity for utilities to look at how can we do that kind of thing? How can we look for partnership opportunities with third parties that have already done a lot of this kind of development? Where could we look at policy changes that would incent customers or incent third parties to bring capital into the market and to make investments? And then where can the utility especially lean into where it could excel, which is, you know, they already have all the data for the electricity system, for the grid. You know, they operate the grid. No matter where you are in the country, there's one utility that operates that distribution system that pushes power around to customers. Where can you really lean into what advantages that you have there and with that knowledge of that infrastructure and how you could operate it more efficiently in order to make sure that as we meet this growing demand, we do so in a way that keeps the system really affordable?
Mm. You mentioned policy change and increased initiatives. How does an organization like your organization or any organization advocate for that kind of change?
Well, there's really two places you can go. One is a public utilities commission or public service commission. Most of the investor-owned utilities in the country are overseen by some sort of regulatory commission. It's either appointed by a state governor or it might be elected. And those are the places where you can usually give feedback on utility proposals. Now, the disadvantage of a utilities commission is, as an independent organization, you can't usually just throw something on the table and say, hey, we'd like you to do this thing. Typically, the way that those systems work is that utility proposes something and then people are reacting to it. There's a whole conversation we could have about why that system might not be designed in the best way to get the best outcomes. But be that as it may, it's a place where you can weigh in, but you're usually doing so in a reactive way. The other place is just as state legislatures. State legislatures usually set energy policy. It's where we've created mandates for clean energy, even mandates for things like rooftop solar. We've created incentive programs to have people install batteries or solar or get electric vehicles. And that's usually the place where you find folks like me or the utilities looking for ways that we can change policy to encourage the kind of development that we think we need to accelerate the clean energy transition.
So let's talk about the current financial model for utilities. How does the approved rate of return and emphasis on capital expenditure disincentivize innovation?
When this model was created over 100 years ago, it was really, I think, thoughtful and matched the need that we had at the time, which was we needed a grid that connected everybody. And it was a huge amount of capital investment that was going to be required. And you have to concentrate that capital investment in larger entities in general to make it cost effective. And so that's what we did. We created a system where we said to the utilities, the way that you're going to earn a return for your shareholders is that you're going to spend money. You're going to invest capital in things. So you're going to build poles and wires and substations and transformers and power plants. And the grid grew enormously from, you know, the early 1900s till about the 1950s when we finally reached that goal of universal service. But the price, the rates that we paid for electricity generally came down over that entire time period because we were doing exactly what we needed, which was you're investing heavily in infrastructure. Electricity demand went up as we used that it could be, we realized that it could be used for all sorts of important productivity enhancements, like switching from gas lamps to electric light bulbs, et cetera. So all that infrastructure really paid back. But what happened then is that we reached this moment. I mean, even in the 50s or 1960s, after we reached that goal of building out the grid initially, where there were other more cost-effective ways to meet the need for the next kilowatt hour than just building a new power plant or building more infrastructure. You know, we've had this tension for decades around things like energy efficiency. So, you know, if you want to tell people, please install an energy efficient appliance or energy efficient light bulbs and reduce your electricity use, well, the utility doesn't make money doing that because their way that they make money is by making that capital investment and then earning a return on the payments that customers make back into that system. And electricity sales are a part of that. I describe it sometimes to people like a motorcycle with a sidecar, that a lot of the policy change that we've tried to get around renewable energy, around energy efficiency is like a sidecar in the motorcycle. It doesn't have any steering capability, right? You're going wherever the motorcycle is going. So it's not really changing the scope and the direction of utilities. They're still really incentivized to go out and build infrastructure. And that's in tension with these other goals. We've seen some early efforts to change that, and I think that's really important to recognize that, you know, if we're going to keep paying utilities to
do the same thing that we've been asking them to do for over 100 years, I think that we can expect them to do it. It's very rational. And if we want them to do something differently, then we really have to confront this question of how do we provide the right financial incentives in order for that development to happen in the way that meets the goals that we have for the system, whether that's reducing pollution or being more affordable or more resilient to climate change. You know, all of those goals should be embodied in however we're providing the financial incentives to utilities.
Mm. You know, there's been a lot of murmurs of regulatory shifts that are pivoting utilities to allow more competition into the market when it comes to distributing energy resources. Some are carrots and the stick. Would you mind discussing those for a brief moment, what you're aware of in that area?
Yeah, so some of the things that we track at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance are policies like community solar, for example. This idea that, you know, everybody has a right to generate energy on their own property, but you have a lot of people for whom that's not possible. Maybe they have a great shade tree they don't want to cut down. Maybe they don't own the house that they live in or the apartment that they live in, and they don't have a way to invest in solar. And the idea behind community solar is, can we create opportunities for folks like that to still invest in the clean energy future? And the beauty of any kind of policy that allows that kind of third-party investment is that we know that we need a lot of investment to change the system from dirty and polluting to clean. And the more we allow other people other than utilities to make those investments, just the more money is available to help make that change. You know, instead of $1 billion that a utility could come up with, maybe we now have $2 billion or $3 billion every year that we can invest in the clean energy transition. And the other thing about community solar in particular is it helps capture some economies of scale, because we know that it's cheaper to build a solar array that's, you know, a megawatt, enough to serve 200 homes rather than one to just serve a single home. And so there's an opportunity there as well with policies like community solar to not only bring in that private investment, but do so in a way that is more economically efficient as well in serving those populations that don't have access to solar. We've seen some states approach this they'll have mandates within like a clean energy standard that will say to the utility, you need to build a certain amount of it at a smaller scale. Maybe there will be incentives. We've seen now, states that are going toward what they call performance-based regulation, where they might say to the utility, meet a certain need on the grid by maybe building that energy in a particular area, building it at a certain scale will actually increase the amount of financial payment that you get. So there are a lot of different ways that this can be approached: mandates, incentives, like you said, carrots or sticks. Things like community solar are just one of the tools that we have available.
Let's talk a little bit more about how these regulations are reshaping the role of utilities and encouraging interconnection with third-party providers. How do you feel about this regulation being used to solve this problem?
We work on clean energy policy because we see it as an opportunity to really widely distribute how we produce electricity and also widely distribute its economic benefits. And I think there's always going to be a tension in this approach of regulatory reform between, if I'm a utility manager right now and we have all these assets in the rate base that we collect that rate of return on, you know, our goal for our shareholders and for our businesses to keep growing that rate base, to keep growing those returns for shareholders. It's difficult to think about how do you create a system in which we say, okay, well, we're going to keep paying the incumbent utility as much as we're paying them now, or maybe even more because they're hoping to really grow their returns like many Wall Street companies. But then we're also going to try to find a way to like reward other people who make investments in clean energy. I think what keeps me hopeful is that with the growing demand, as we shift uses like from gasoline for our cars to electricity, gas furnaces to heat pumps, is that the pie is growing a lot in the next couple of decades. And so even if we take a bigger slice of it for folks who are not the utility, I think the utility can still have a growing slice for itself. And I think that does give us an opportunity to say, okay, maybe what we really need to be focused on right now is how do we reform the rules for the utility? How do we redirect its energies into things that are of the highest possible value in terms of clean energy deployment? And also, how do we figure out in when it comes down to the nuts and bolts to like share opportunities? So just to go back to that proposal I mentioned earlier that Xcel Energy had done in Minnesota to say, oh, we want to build 800 megawatts of solar and energy storage on like warehouse rooftops. Okay, that's interesting. Can we create a system in which there is a built opportunity for a market for third parties to also offer that kind of solar and energy storage at the same time that the utility does it? Is it possible to do it in a fair way? And I could talk more about sort of the challenges of doing that when the utility is like has name recognition and manages the grid and whatnot. But I think that's where I would look at the opportunity and say, okay, can we find a way that the utility can make investments in a way that we all recognize is logical. Investing in decentralized distributed energy is cost effective. It has lots of benefits. But can we do that in a way that also opens the door and says, hey, we have a lot of investment that we need. So it would be really wise to let other people into this and not have it be monopolized the way that we've traditionally done power plant infrastructure. Can we also do it in a way that, you know, is a win-win that gives the utility opportunities to figure out how to coordinate and manage all of these resources in a way that operates most efficiently and lets those third parties come in and find interesting and unique ways to serve the community?
That's a beautiful segue into the next part of this podcast that I wanted to discuss. You know, there's been a lot of talk of companies like Amazon and Google exploring their own generation projects, especially within nuclear power. What are your thoughts on this trend? How do you think this might impact utilities, this kind of threat of these new large organizations coming in and wanting a piece of the pie?
I mean, I have a lot of concerns about big tech companies getting into this space, in part because the big tech companies are sort of the original monopoly problem that we've been talking about as a society over the last few years about. You know, I just saw an article today about how federal regulators are looking at asking Google to sell off its Chrome browser, for example, to like separate out the ways in which it sort of like connects all these services and really locks you in. I'm trying to avoid going onto too much of a tangent there. I'll just say, I think if I was a utility company, I would be concerned because these are entities with as, you know, the same kind of financial resources and even political power that you have. And so it is going to be challenging to figure that out. There was already a really interesting case sort of being litigated where I think Amazon wanted to build its data center, and they called it sort of with behind the fence at a nuclear power plant. So the nuclear power plant is not owned by an investor-owned utility. It's owned by some third party already, an independent power producer. Amazon is basically saying, we'll build our data center right next door to the nuclear power plant. So we're not going to use any of the transmission infrastructure or whatever, the greater grid. We're just being served right here. And it's not that simple, unfortunately. Like big power plants, even like a nuclear power plant, like they actually need electricity from somewhere else to operate their backup machinery and stuff if like the internal stuff goes down. So they have grid needs anyway. But you also just have this question of like, is Amazon going to pay its fair share of the infrastructure that it probably is going to rely on and that it was kind of hoping to avoid paying for, honestly. So there's this like equity issue where, interestingly, we have fights with utilities and independent power producers at the small scale a lot about, and now here it's happening at a large scale. So it's sort of amusing on one hand, but also really concerning that we have to figure out these issues of, are these big tech companies going to build data centers and get sweetheart deals, either from these independent power producers or from utilities themselves, because they have such big electric demand in ways that are really going to impact customers. I think I heard somewhere that, for example, like a quarter of the electricity demand for Dominion Power in Virginia comes from data centers. Yeah. Right now, my question is, you know, how much of that is being paid for by other customers in order to justify, you know, the enormous expense of serving those data centers? And one of the things I keep thinking about too is that there is a rationale sometimes to say, okay, well, we'll have lower electric rates for a big industry out of a desire to provide economic development. This is something Minnesota faces all the time. Up in northern Minnesota, we have mining industries, for example. And there's been a longstanding idea that we are dealing with an industry that is, you know, selling its product on the world market, and it needs to keep its electricity costs low if it's going to be competitive. Yeah, if you want a data center, I mean, you've got to bid for it by having low-cost electricity, but it doesn't really create a lot of jobs. And it's not like, you know, Eastern Virginia has computer manufacturing, like for the computer chips that are going into it, those are being imported from somewhere else. You know, you only need like 5 people to walk around a data center and make sure that everything's running. Are we managing this well? Are we making sure that this is not just like one big corporation coming in and getting a sweetheart deal at the expense of other customers? Kind of going back to that question of demand as well, you know, I worry that utilities will get, you know, too sucked into this idea that these data centers are actually coming and are going to be this expensive and make problematic plans around that, where, you know, maybe we don't need as much electricity as we thought we did if the AI boom doesn't turn out the way that we expected. I'll say one other thing about the sort of nuclear power thing, which is it's really expensive to build a nuclear plant. Just ask the customers of Georgia Power, whose bills went up by like, you know, hundreds of dollars a year when that most recent nuclear power plant came online. So I'm always extremely skeptical of the idea that anybody, whether it's a utility or a, you know, Microsoft or whoever thinks that they can get a nuclear power plant operating cheaply, can do so. I mean, that's been the promise since the 1960s that electricity would be too cheap to meter. It's never panned out. And so I think we just have to be realistic that if we're going to have really large electricity demands, whether it's from data centers or, you know, Bitcoin operations, it's just going to be a lot of energy that you have to produce. And we have to figure out a cost-effective way to do that. And I don't think big tech has any secret sauce any more so than utilities do.
Interesting. So we talked about the cost for communities, right? That's definitely been covered. But do you not see an advantage for them coming in and impacting positively grid reliability, for example?
One of the lessons of the 20th century was that growing electricity demand in general can make it less expensive for everybody, like the incremental cost. And so there is an opportunity here with data centers to think about if we sign the contracts fairly, if they're priced fairly, I do see an opportunity potentially to say, okay, these data centers, by helping the broader system operate more efficiently, because they're essentially always on running 24/7, there's an opportunity to lower costs for other customers. I think that would be exciting. In terms of like reliability benefits, I mean, if data centers are building energy storage on site or other tools that the utility can use to help support reliability, I could see that. But I don't think just adding a bunch of electricity demand necessarily has any reliability benefit. Even if it's around the clock, I mean, it's just more demand for the utility to manage, and they have to do that all the time. If you drop a huge load all at once, in the same way that if a power plant goes out, it's actually a really big managerial problem for the utility. So to some degree, very large anything on the system creates a very challenging management problem, because if there's an outage or if that thing is disconnected, you have a lot to deal with. I mean, just think about it right now. I could go over to the light switch in my house and flick it on and off a million times. I am changing the demand from the utility, but it's such a small amount that it doesn't really matter. It's just a wash in the bigger system. But a data center is huge. Mm-hmm. So I think being aware that it creates its own unique challenge for the system in being built is just part of how we have to account for it as we think about how many we add and to what degree they impact the system.
Next, I want to look at some of the utilities that are paving the way in the area of decentralization. We talked a little bit, you and I, John, offline about Green Mountain Power's storage initiative and connected solutions at National Grid. Let's talk a little bit more about that.
You know, the Green Mountain Power one is super interesting. And I'll just say it's such an interesting utility as well, in the sense that I think it had sort of a cultural shift maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, to really think about decentralization. They also at the same time changed their corporate charter to be a benefit corporation. It's the only for-profit utility in the country that has that charter. And it means that they consider sort of like the broader impact of their business as part of their bottom line, which is really intriguing. Energy storage program that they created is essentially they would pay for upfront batteries on their customer property. The customer has the benefit of having availability of backup power. And then the customer essentially like pays back the battery through their electric bill to the utility company, but at a subsidized rate, because the utility is able to use those batteries to enhance reliability and operational efficiency of the grid system. And potentially, I think, and this is part of the goal behind it, to avoid big capital investments that might otherwise be needed. So just to think about, you know, if you have a substation serving a neighborhood that's growing really fast, and you're thinking as a utility, oh, you know, we're going to hit the limits of the hardware in that substation pretty soon, we would have to upgrade it. But instead, you use battery storage, you know, that's on your customer's property, and you store energy overnight when demand is relatively low, and you save it for those moments when you're reaching the peak capacity of that substation. Maybe you're able to put off that substation upgrade for 3, 4, 5, even 10 years by making these investments on customer property. You're doing it in an incremental way, so you're kind of spending your money more efficiently. Your customers are helping pay for it, but they're seeing a benefit from it because they're getting backup power when the grid goes down. So it's like this, I don't know how many people are involved here. There's a win-win-win. Maybe it's win-win-win-win, right? Like it's good for the environment as well. It's good for the efficiency of the system. So it's a really exciting program that has, you know, helped to lower the upfront cost for people to do storage, that has benefits for those individuals and for the grid, and that the utility took a lead in doing. Does a utility have to be involved all the time to do that? No, but they did it, and they've really expanded that program a lot, and I think are seeing really significant benefits from it. So I do wish that there were other utilities proposing similar programs, because I think it's really intriguing. And then the other program you mentioned, Connected Solutions, is less of utility hardware ownership, but more of utility managing all of these decentralized
resources. So they have, there are two key hardware components that are included in the program. There's things like smart thermostats that the utility would have some control over, and then battery storage. And in this case, it can be more of a like bring your own thing. Like, I have a battery and I'm signing up for this program. And the beauty behind it is that, you know, the utility gives customers a payment on their bill, an incentive payment, to be able to control that device, whether it's the smart thermostat or the battery storage. And there are rules for it, right? They're not going to like turn your air conditioning off completely on a hot day, but they're going to cycle it off, or they're going to turn it down, you know, particularly if you have some of the newer hardware that allows the more variable output. You probably won't notice the impact. I mean, I have a radio control on my house that does this. It's been around for decades, but you know, they're getting more sophisticated now with the smart thermostats. They'll cycle off the compressor in your air conditioner for 15 minutes out of the hour. The fan blower still goes in the house. You're generally still getting air conditioning most of the day, but they're able to shave off a little bit of demand at a time when it's really expensive to provide electricity on the grid. And the batteries just are provide that, you know, but 10 times better, right? Because now you can use the batteries when you have too much electricity production in a local area. Maybe there's lots of customers that have solar panels and they're all producing and but nobody's home and using electricity. Now you can soak up that extra energy with the batteries and then put it back on the grid at the time that you need it. Maybe you're having a voltage problem on the grid because one of your power generators went out, and you can use the energy from those batteries to support it. So management complexity for the grid is just going up, you know, orders of magnitude, because we're going from, you know, maybe there were 150 power plants that the utility is managing, and that was all the energy production on the entire electricity system that they operated in the entire state. And now we've got all these batteries and rooftop solar arrays and, you know, maybe even like smaller scale wind or solar projects. And the utility just has so much more to manage. It's both a challenge and an opportunity. The challenge is, how do you get a window into what are all these things doing at different points in time? But the opportunity is, if we're able to see into that level of grid operation, if we're able to have some ability to control how those things operate in exchange for paying our customers to help us, we can make the grid much more efficient. Like, we have all these different levers that we can use, all these dials that we never had before, that allow the utility more fine-grained control. So there's, I think, some big opportunities for utilities to make investments in ways to make the grid operate more efficiently, both in partnership with their customers and with their own investments.
One of the pain points I've heard about is the very high cost of grid interconnections. How do you think that the cost burden should be split between utilities and ratepayers in this area?
Oh, I love this question. It's like the perfect one for an energy nerd like myself. I mean, I think what is really interesting here to think about is, when we talk about a utility scale power plant, we always socialize the cost of interconnection, whether it's a new transmission line or just a new, you know, lower voltage line that connects that project to the transmission system. We're all paying for that. And with all of these customer owned systems, we generally have the rule that the person who causes the need for the upgrade pays for it. So I'm a community solar project and I'm building on some unused land in an area where there wasn't a lot of grid capacity before, and we need to upgrade a transformer, or maybe we need to even upgrade the power line itself. I could be a residential customer in a neighborhood where lots of people have solar panels, and all of a sudden there's just not enough capacity on that line at noon on a sunny day to absorb that electricity production. So the philosophy has been that, as I think that the way they describe it, is the cost causer pays. I start with one part of this, which is sort of the philosophical approach, which is to say, if we have on the large scale side, we socialize the cost, and then at the small scale side, we make the individual pay, there's a little bit of an inconsistency here. Like, we're looking at these assets differently at a time when I think we need to actually be considering them sort of equally. They both offer important resources to the grid. They're both producing, in this case, like clean electricity. So we want that to happen. We don't want interconnection costs to be a barrier. So how do we facilitate that instead of ending up, I think there's this inclination to say, well, this is just how the interconnection process works. So, you know, you quote the person with the solar array, like, it's going to be $10,000 for that upgrade. Well, maybe now they don't do that solar installation. And I think there is a tendency to sort of shrug and say, well, that's the policy, right? And, it, you know, if you're the utility, that's as far as the policy requires you to go, then that's as far as you go. And there's maybe not a lot of creative thinking, unfortunately, about how we address that. But moving beyond that and thinking about kind of how we handle interconnection? I think there's sort of like that broader philosophical question, but then there's sort of the nuts and bolts of how do you deal with a problem when it arises, and what are some creative approaches to it, and how do you write the rules in such a way that encourages utilities and participants to work together to solve it. So I'll just give a few examples of what I've seen that I think would be really interesting. One of them is, say, get for like community solar or other third-party developed solar infrastructure. If they're building in the same place, like connecting to the same power line, letting them share the cost of that upgrade. So instead of saying like, oh, you, Project A, came first, you're going to pay $1 million to do a substation upgrade, and Project B, you came second, you get to connect for free because that substation upgrade got paid for by Project A. Why don't we instead say, okay, we actually have projects A, B, C, D, and E that all want to connect here, that have all filed interconnection aims. Let's split that cost. You know, it'll be $200,000 per project, or maybe we'll even size it based on the size of the project. So, you know, we'll do some proportionate distribution of those costs. Another thing is just looking at what if we make an agreement with the customer. So it's like, you know, I have a 100 kilowatt solar array that I was going to put on a hardware store or something, and that's what's going to overload the line. But it's actually 1 kilowatt is going to put it over the limit. If I just did 99, I'd be okay. So maybe you say to the customer, hey, we have an interconnection cost that's going to be very expensive for you to connect this project. But if you actually just take a kilowatt of panels off, you don't have any interconnection cost at all because you'll be under that limit. So you could make a hardware decision. Or you can make a software decision. Maybe you say to the customer, you need to run your inverter in such a way that the most you're going to export is 99 kilowatts. So you can have 100 kilowatts worth of panels, but you can never export to the grid more than 99. You know, usually the increment's probably not that small, but you get the idea here, right? That there are ways that we can approach this. And there are now actually some states considering policy that they call flexible interconnection that will do this, that actually sets up a sort of rule set that says, okay, instead of simply talking about this as a hardware problem, how do we encourage creative approaches to it? And that might include saying to a customer, okay, the utility has the right to curtail your output, you know, 1% of the hours in a year at times when it would otherwise be overloaded. And as long as you're okay with that, then you can interconnect immediately and for free or for a very low cost. So I think we have a lot of intriguing approaches to dealing with interconnection. The biggest thing, though, is like, can we make this mind shift to recognize that no matter who builds it, we're having people put assets on the grid that are valuable. And so how do we organize our system in a way to encourage that to happen and to do it in a way that just maximizes the efficiency of that infrastructure, maximizes the good use of that infrastructure, and allocates costs as fairly as possible?
One of the things we've talked about is the pie becoming larger, the increase in competition in general, and the evolving role of utilities in this area. If utilities move towards more of a role as a grid conductor, you know, coordinating the energy supply and demand, what do you think that might look like?
There was a lovely interview on another podcast of this fellow, Lorenzo Christoph, but the two of them have such a lovely insight into sort of the two things that we face. So Lorenzo worked, you know, like I said, on the transmission operator at a level where, you know, there's, like I said, a few hundred power plants or entities that you have to work with, right? So the coordination problem is relatively minimal. Astrid used to work at Google, and they obviously had an enormous scale-up problem as more and more people had computers and were doing searches and whatnot. And she talks about like the challenge of creating the infrastructure to manage all of those devices, you know, manage all of those searches in case of Google, and how they realized that they needed to decentralize things. And then Lorenzo has kind of taken that learning and applied it to the grid and said, what we really need to do is push down that decision-making and management to a level that is scalable. So instead of saying the transmission operator in one central office across the whole state of California is going to manage 1.5 million devices and solar panels and energy storage facilities. I mean, it's probably more than that, probably like 10 million, right? That you say, okay, at the transmission level, we're going to manage 150 power plants, and then we're going to manage 10 different nodes across California. And then those 10 different node operators are each in turn going to have, you know, maybe 100 substations that they're responsible for. And then each of those 100 substations is in turn responsible for everything below that level. That goes down to the distribution feeders and is, you know, however many customers are connected to that particular substation.
you know, which may still be in the thousands, but now you're talking about smaller increments of electricity. So it makes it more manageable. So what I think about when I think about how utilities transition or think about operating in a decentralized future, I think about it's making those kinds of operational decisions to decentralize management of the grid out of one particular control room and into multiple different control rooms. And each one of those then is only responsible for reporting up the chain, sort of the big picture. So instead of that independent operator in the control room saying like, oh my gosh, we have 15 houses on this one feeder in this one town that are causing an overload, the first thing that happens is the substation operator in that area says, what can we do to manage it here? What battery storage could we deploy? What resources do we have locally that we can do something with? And, you know, 9 times out of 10, they don't have a problem they have to report up. They actually solve it locally. And maybe that's because they've made an infrastructure investment in upgrading a substation or upgrading a transformer. Maybe it's because they have given incentives to give people along that particular distribution feeder and said, hey, we'll pay you to install energy storage, or we'll finance it for you if you're willing to do energy storage, as long as you give us control over it so that we can manage it in these circumstances that we're seeing. And so you've decentralized the management and operation of the system then in a way that makes it easier up at the top to keep that picture clean of like, we're managing 150 power plants. We need to be concerned when that nuclear plant has an outage or a repair or a refueling operation, not whether or not those 15 folks in that one neighborhood are all of a sudden plugging in all their cars at 5 p.m. That's somebody else's problem. And if it accumulates to the level of the transmission system, as in, you know, we have more bulk energy needs, then we manage it at that level. But otherwise, we try to push down that management. And I think what we'll find from that not only is that, first of all, it will actually be possible to manage all of these devices, because at the level we're talking about, you know, like 10 million devices, you simply can't do that in centralized infrastructure. That was the lesson that Google had. They started putting servers all across the world. And, you know, one of the examples that she gave, I thought that was so funny, that I thought that really resonated for me, was, you know, if people in Azerbaijan particularly like this one cat video, then we just cache that cat video at that one server location. And that way we manage the demand locally. And that's the same kind of way that we need to think about managing the grid, is that demands of different neighborhoods and of different communities are going to be different. Maybe one is really agricultural heavy. Maybe one is really commercial heavy. Maybe one is residential. Let's, you know, decentralize that management infrastructure in a way that's going to allow us to accommodate the way the grid can operate today.
Well, that's a fascinating analogy. Very interesting. We're about running out of time, John. I'd like to get a little bit more insight from you, a self-proclaimed energy nerd. What is the one message you'd like to leave electric utility leaders with? What would it be?
Look for how you can get into this decentralized opportunity and sell us on it in the terms that those of us who work in the energy system and customers want. Talk to me about how you can make energy more affordable, more reliable, and cleaner as you look for these financial opportunities for your business. I think one of the things that we are seeing right now is this enormous upward pressure. You know, we had inflationary pressure on all sorts of things in people's lives, and electricity bills are going up in a lot of places. I think we have the opportunities and the technology in front of us that utilities can find a way to meet the demands of the future and keep our energy bills from rising, but they need to prove it. And I think that's the sales pitch they've got in front of them. And I think they have the tools they need. So sell us on it. Get into this space and make investments in this space and make it worth our while.
Yeah, definitely a massive challenge for utilities, but also great opportunity as well. I really appreciate you joining us, John. Thank you so much for your insight.
Well, thanks for having me.
Have a good day.
You too.
Thank you for listening to Amped Up. If you like this conversation, please support this content. Subscribe and rate the show on YouTube, Apple Podcast, or Spotify.